Shabbat shalom. Thank you so much, Rabbi Resnick. Thank you to Vivian Feberman Ivory for inviting me here today. And really and truly, the people who are responsible for me being with you this Shabbat are Mimi and Bernie Cotter. So thank you so much for helping to make this happen. You know, so much of the discussion and the debate around intermarriage focuses on whether rabbis should or should not officiate when weddings are taking place. It's a very important question. I wrestled with it for many, many years and decided 4 years ago to actually resign from the Rabbinical Assembly and the conservative movement in order to be able to stand under the chuppah with intermarrying couples who are committed to rooting their lives in the Jewish community, establishing Jewish homes, raising Jewish families. I wrote about it in an article that was published in Tablet magazine a few years ago titled Intermarriage I Do. I invite you to read it. It chronicles a very interesting journey that really shaped the future of my rabbinate. But I really do believe that at this moment in time, there are bigger issues at stake than simply who officiates and how. I should mention also that when I do officiate, it's not the traditional Jewish wedding ceremony that's just superimposed upon a Jew and someone from another identity. It's an adapted ceremony. It's not the traditional wedding ceremony. But I want to say that I really think that question is secondary now. For me, the most urgent priority, the most urgent campaign is to ensure the strengthening and the growth of Jewish homes and Jewish families of all backgrounds in order to secure our Jewish future. A campaign directed not only at multi-faith or multi-heritage families, but at the vast plurality of Jews, as Rabbi Resnick just mentioned, who have perhaps little or no Jewish literacy or inspiration, and consequently little or no Jewish engagement. Cultivating a vibrant, dynamic, committed, rooted Jewish people, as diverse as we may be and yet become, in our post-ethnic, voluntary, fluid, hybrid marketplace of identities in which we are living, to me, that is the most important work that we can be doing, all of us, whether we officiate at intermarriages or not. And I understand the various positions that are out there in the community on that question, even as I'm deeply committed to my own. But still, when exploring how our Jewish communities should engage with the significant and rapidly increasing numbers of non-Jews who are joining our families, our shuls, sitting around our Shabbat tables, and soon our Pesach Seders, the Jewish way is to turn to the treasure of Jewish wisdom to help illuminate our responses, to help illuminate the way in which we embrace these new realities. Some of our colleagues have advocated renewing ancient categories of non-Jews who used to participate in Jewish life, like the Ger Toshav, the resident alien, or the Yirei Hashem, the God-fearers. I find these models interesting but limited, because I think putting people in boxes really does more to assuage our own concerns and our own guilt, and really does not reflect the reality of the diverse people who are coming into our homes and into our communities. And many of them resist being categorized in any way. So we have to, I think carefully about that. Many scholars, many rabbis have turned to texts that speak to the urgency of action when our world needs leadership, bringing out sources like Eit la'asot la'Hashem heferu to'artecha, it is time to act for God, even because engaging in an action that might be transgressive if it's for the larger purpose of strengthening our communities. Some people invoke halachic categories like nishtanu hazmanim, the times have changed, which is a legal category in rabbinic literature that is often invoked when new models or new precedents need to be set. And sometimes people will invoke the moral imperative of ve'ahavta et ager, that we are commanded to love the stranger. All of these help to provide a moral or legal or spiritual frame for their choices. What I want to do today with you is to share with you three texts, three traditions that help to cultivate a values-based framework with which to talk about the question of multi-faith marriage and multi-heritage marriage and the presence of people from other backgrounds in our communities and in our families. A language to talk about the challenges that these realities present to us. What is the role of people who aren't Jewish in our communities, in ritual, in liturgy, in leadership, and not just in synagogues, but in all different kinds of Jewish organizations? What does Jewishness itself mean? when it's lived in open, pluralistic, post-ethnic societies? And how can we convey a new paradigm for living Jewishly without losing its texture and its multidimensionality? Particularly when, for a growing segment of our own community, it's less about, these days, God and theology and halakha, and more about culture and heritage. How do we put legs on that? And how do we make that association thick enough to be transmittable to the next generations? What makes a marriage a Jewish marriage, other than the identity of the two people who may be covenanted one to another? Right? What makes a marriage a Jewish marriage? As we create new models of Jewish families and communities, what is our responsibility to the past as we build a new future? So before I share the three pieces that really have helped to shape where I am on this issue and the conversation that I think we need to be having, I want to just make a note on language. I think that our language is really impoverished in this conversation. I think the word non-Jew is a terrible word. We are not the center of the universe, such that anyone who isn't part of our identity is simply not us. We need better language around that. Person of another faith or culture is more accurate, but it's also a little clunky. So if anybody has any ideas, I am all ears. And secondly, I think the term intermarriage itself is not a great term, because it suggests some kind of coming together of two different sides and the creation of some third entity. And a more appropriate term is, I believe, multi-faith or multi-heritage, that allows for an honoring of the different identities that come into play in any particular relationship. Number one, I want to bring you back to a scene that we'll be reading about shortly in the Torah reading cycle that actually is an incredibly significant and thought-provoking scene. So Moses is up on the mountain, and he's received the Torah from God, and he's coming down very proudly and happily with the Luchot HaBrit, with the tablets of the law in his arms. And he's heading down the mountain, and what does he see? He sees the golden calf, and he stops and he thinks, what do I do now? Here I have the Torah in my hands. That's in the Torah, it says, you shall not make, right, any idols and have no other gods beside me. And he's bringing it down to a people who have done just that. And in a moment that is so filled with urgency and drama, Moses has to decide whether he's going to bring this Torah down to a people and instantly have them be liable, right, for this sin. Or is he going to reject the Torah and stand by the people? And in that moment, Moses makes a decision in this brilliant, beautiful midrash from Avot Rabbi Natan. Moses makes a decision to turn around and head back up the mountain, choosing the imperfect people over the supposedly perfect Torah by not bringing the Torah down to them. And the elders who are there see him and they run after him. Come on, Moses, come back down. No, where are you going? And the Midrash says that they held on to the tablets when they caught up to him. And if the elders caught up to him, he probably wasn't running that fast. Another indication of his own conflictedness, right? They hold on to the Torah, and Moses is holding on to the Torah. And the Midrash says they pulled one way and he pulled the other way. Imagine this whole tug of war going on over the tablets of the law. But Moses was stronger and he prevailed. And when he looked at the tablets after prevailing, he noticed that all of the writing on the tablets disappeared. At which point he said, how can I bring blank tablets down to the people? And so then Moses said, better I should just smash them. And Moses throws down the tablets of the law. The rabbis identify this as one moment, one of a few in our tradition, where Moses takes the initiative and God follows Moses' lead. Because the writing disappearing after the tug of war is an indication that God actually agreed with Moses' decision to withhold the perfect Torah from the imperfect people for the sake of the people. Now, it's a memory that will not leave me ever. When about 10 years ago, Rabbi Daniel Hartman shared this midrash in northern New Jersey with about 35 of us rabbis. And he challenged us by saying, in every generation, leaders have to decide what of the Torah to break, to fracture, to disassemble, and then to reassemble in order to be able to stand by and with the people. We are not the first, and we will not be the last, faced with those kinds of choices. The smashing of the tablets is a jarring image. The shattering of Torah. Where did those shards end up, by the way? The shards of that first Torah that was smashed ended up in the ark alongside the second whole set. And those shards got carried along with us, along our journey through not just the desert, but through thousands of years of our history. They are metaphorically carried along with us. Smashing the tablets on the slopes of Sinai, Moses chooses this imperfect, unpredictable people over the inviolable, unchanging tablets and initiates the sacred dynamic of writing and rewriting Torah in every generation, of disassembling precedent and reassembling new traditions in every generation. But they live, those fragments of disassembling live along with us, reminding us that to find and nourish wholeness is to live from within life's inevitable brokenness, that really is the narrative of human existence. And by the way, we carry with us proudly the fragments of former shatterings. Matrilineal descent itself is a shattering of the biblical precedent of patrilineality. The banning of polygamy, that's a shattering of a precedent in our tradition which allowed it. The requirement of a wife's consent to divorce is a shattering of a precedent that previously did not require it. The ability for someone who is converted to Judaism to marry a Kohen, that is a decision the conservative movement took in the 1960s, that required a disassembling of precedent and a reassembling into a new tradition. I stand here before you as a woman who is a rabbi. I am a living fragment of the shattering of Torah, which said that only men can aspire to religious leadership. The enfranchisement of the LGBTQ community required a shattering and a disassembling and then a reassembling of Torah in order to address and embrace new realities. The shattering of Torah is the source of our continuity, not the source of our dissolution. The presence of people who come from other religious traditions or cultures within our families and communities adds another chapter to that endless story, brings a new tug of war between the past and the future. What is it that we ought to hang on to, and what is it are we prepared to let go of? To what are we more obligated, the past or the future? When is it more prudent to embrace our traditions and our precedents with a tighter grip, and when ought we loosen our grip to make way for new realities? You mentioned the story about Rabbi Schulweis. I was born and raised in the Orthodox community of Montreal, Quebec. As far as I know, still part of Canada. And my grandfather was a very well-known, very prominent Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Mendel Lewittis, Zichrono Livracha. My grandfather taught me many, many, many things, one of which is the difference between a rabbi and a parrot. My grandfather taught me that for a rabbi to simply reiterate every single decision that their teachers had taught them is not to be a rabbi. That's what it means to be a parrot. But for a rabbi to look out upon the people and upon the needs of their time and to make decisions and establish realities, establish ways of engaging with that reality, to strengthen Judaism and the Jewish people in their time and in their day, even if that requires new patterns and new norms, that's what it means to be a rabbi. To live from hope and not from fear. By the way, when Moshe smashed those tablets, did he know that a second set was going to be forthcoming? No, he didn't. That was a decision made from hope and trust, not from fear. And there's a lot for us to learn from that. Number two, the importance of narrative. Many have asked why it is that if the core of the Torah is all about mitzvot, then why is it that the Torah is filled with so much narrative? Why doesn't the Torah begin with the commandments instead of with all of these stories about people and families in the book of Genesis? The ancient rabbis of the Midrash teach us that the narrative portions of the Torah are much more precious than the legal sections. Why? Because it's precisely the narrative portions of the Torah where we learned how people strive to live with one another, search for meaning and relationship to higher powers, how they balance family and work and community and drive and humility, sibling rivalry, how they negotiate loss and suffering, as all these stories in the book of Genesis do. They set the sacred tone. They define the holy settings in which we can hear and later respond to the call of the commandments. In 1983, a legal scholar by the name of Robert Cover published an article in the Harvard Law Review called Nomos and Narrative. And he makes the point in that article that every legal system has a story or stories that serve as the background from which norms and patterns emerge and that lend them credibility when these stories later make claims upon our lives. Think of the Torah's commandment that we treat the stranger and the widow and the orphan with kindness. Why? Because you yourselves were slaves in Egypt. That phrase repeated more than any other phrase in the whole Torah. That narrative, that story of our slavery is what makes us more responsive when our tradition demands that we treat others with kindness and that we bring freedom to others. And narrative, Robert Cover taught, is also redemptive because as stories evolve, so do the norms and patterns that we learn from them. So what is the story about intermarriage in the Jewish community? For many, many decades, the story about intermarriage, the storm story, was that anybody who married somebody from beyond the Jewish community was expressing their rejection of their Jewish identity and their lack of interest or commitment in Judaism and Jewish life. If you married out, you knew decades ago that you were going to lose your place in the community because the community was not prepared to embrace you. But that story has changed. That story has changed. The old themes that framed the narrative of intermarriage as a rejection of Jewish identity has given way to the narrative frame that intermarriage is a reflection of American Jewish integration, and that it is a narrative that's consistent with our Jewish identity. We live today in a story of intermarriage where whom you marry is not a reflection of how deeply you may yet care about your Jewish identity and being a part of a Jewish community. We Jews fought, and we Jews even died for the opportunity to be integrated as fully into American society as we have become. And it was inevitable that we and our children and grandchildren would meet people from other backgrounds in the spaces that we fought so hard to have access to, and that they would inevitably fall in love with them. But we live in a world where someone who engages in a relationship with someone of another background is not necessarily making the statement that they no longer care about their Jewish identity and that they no longer want to be a part of the Jewish community. And we have to listen to that story very carefully. Now we're wondering what our response should be, how we can retain a sense of unified peoplehood around our Shabbat tables and our seders when members of our own families are not Jewish. What will continue to unite us as this story unfolds? What is the story that we can now tell ourselves about intermarriage in the Jewish community in the 21st century? I want to tell you a story about a couple that I worked with, Rachel and Stephen. Stephen is a Mexican-American. Rachel grew up in a traditional Jewish family in the New York area. I'm quoting from Stephen. Rachel and I come from different religious backgrounds. I grew up Catholic, Rachel grew up Jewish, and both of those identities meant a lot to us growing up. And so for us, what we landed on when we got married is that we knew that we wanted to have a Jewish household, and we knew it was important to us, and we knew we wanted our wedding to be the start of that Jewish life together. And so we really needed someone who understood the uniqueness of our identities and could figure out a way with us how we can start that journey together and weave that together into the start of a Jewish home. That is Stephen, the Mexican-American, non-Jewish groom in this couple. Rachel had beautiful things to say also about the fact that when they were interviewing rabbis before they met me, a lot of rabbis said, oh, sure, I'll marry you. I'll do whatever you want, whatever kind of ceremony. That's no problem for me. And Rachel says, I didn't want a rabbi to do whatever I wanted. I wanted a rabbi to guide me to understand how I can bring the love of my life into my Jewish community, into my Jewish family, and together with him, build a Jewish future. I wanted someone who would challenge me, which I did. I wanted someone who would show me how to take responsibility for my Jewish life in this reality. What strikes me about Rachel and Stephen is their articulation of a commitment to build a Jewish home wasn't coming from Rachel that Stephen kind of you know, went along with. It was an articulation that they both made, that they both shared. They didn't want a rabbi to just do whatever they wanted. They wanted guidance. They want to see themselves as part of the larger Jewish story. I will tell you also that Rachel's grandfather is a survivor of the Shoah, a survivor of the Holocaust. And when their relationship got serious enough and Stephen became as much a part of the community as he clearly became, Rachel's grandfather sat him down one day and told him of his experiences in the Holocaust. And Stephen was shaken to his core, not only by the details of the stories. Stephen was shaken to his core in realizing that he was now going to take the responsibility for perpetuating the stories of the Jewish people during the Holocaust. That as the husband of Rachel, he was now going to be the repository of memory for the next generation of the Jewish community and for all of humanity. And he undertook that responsibility with great seriousness and with great pride. When I thanked Stephen for his commitment to marry Rachel and to want to invest in the establishment of a Jewish home, Jewish children, which they thank God now have, he was overwhelmed that I would come to him and say thank you. But we owe these people an enormous debt of gratitude. You know, when I stand under the chuppah with couples who are marrying, who come from a Jewish background and another background, every single time I say to them that we celebrate you, we expect you and want you to live your lives in the Jewish community. We want and expect that you will live your lives according to the rhythm of the Jewish calendar and the values of the Jewish people. And I often, if not always, have parents running over to me after the ceremony saying, "Thank you for reminding my children that they continue to have Jewish responsibilities and that their Jewish responsibilities matter." It's not the case that just because you marry somebody who isn't Jewish, you no longer matter to the Jewish community. You continue to have responsibilities and your choices matter. And you know what it feels like to be told that you matter to the Jewish community? That's an ennobling experience. We have to continue to tell couples that they matter to the Jewish community. About a year ago, I married a couple from Turkey. The groom grew up in a deeply traditional, Orthodox, Turkish Jewish family. The bride from a secular Muslim father and a secular Christian mother. And when I was going over the ceremony with them, I explained to the groom that though I will be there and we will marry them, the traditional ceremony is not going to be the one that we're going to engage in together. And I shared with him the words that I suggested he say to his wife under the chuppah. Words that are not the traditional words of Hareyat Mikudeshet Li, right? Here I betroth you to me according to the laws of Moses in Israel. And he looked at me and he said, "Dini, but wait a minute. I understand that it's not the same exact wedding ceremony. I understand these are different circumstances." He said, "But I have to be able to say something to my wife that does in fact invoke Moses and the people of Israel, because I would not be standing here today as the man that I am, capable of loving in the way I love her and completely devoted to the Jewish family that I know I will create with her, unless I can show my gratitude and my respect for my tradition, for Moses and for my people." He couldn't imagine not acknowledging the power of his Jewish roots. In that moment, it was an extraordinary experience. And we have to ask ourselves, are we the gatekeepers of Jewish expression? Are we the guards at the gate saying, "You can come in, you have to stay out"? Or are we the facilitators of Jewish experience? Are we the mediators of Jewish meaning for people today and every day going forward? Equally important in the question of narrative is whether we can live with conflicting narratives. Can we live with narratives that seem to be opposite to one another? I was meeting with a woman a few months ago whose son was marrying a woman from another culture, another faith background. She told me a story about how at one Shabbat dinner with her three sons, including this one who was engaged to this woman, she said something like the following. "Oh, you know, her younger son is off to university. And she said, I hope he meets a nice Jewish girl there." Right? But sitting at the table was her other son and his non-Jewish fiance. Okay? So you can imagine how her son and his non-Jewish fiance felt when she said, "I hope your brother meets a nice Jewish girl at university." The question is, can we as a community hold as sacred different narratives at one and the same time? She was doing everything she could to honor and to be present for the choices that her son was making to marry somebody beyond the Jewish community and committed to raising a Jewish family. But she also still feels very deeply that she hopes her other children will find people to share their lives with who also share their Jewish identity. Can families, can communities contain within them narratives that aren't exactly identical and still make room for everyone's truth and for everyone's authenticity? Can this son who's engaged respect the fact that his mother comes with a different narrative? Can the mother understand that not all of her children will choose that same story? These are the questions that we have to be able to wrestle with. And finally, what if it isn't just the players who are changing, but the very nature of the game? Is Jewishness, as Rabbi Resnick opened with earlier, is Jewishness only about ritual observance and halachic observance? Isn't it also about land and family and history and memory and culture? And is there a way for someone who comes from beyond our Jewish community to take those on as well as meaningful parts of their new Jewish identity? Not every person comes to the Jewish community with a sort of theological or spiritual inspiration. Not everybody is moved to consider converting to Judaism, and sometimes it's for very, very good reasons. Right? Sometimes it's out of respect to their own family. Sometimes it's because they are not looking to be taken as one of a student that I worked with once said, not looking to be led on a hike up Mount Sinai to meet God. Sometimes it's an appreciation for the culture, for the heritage, for the texture of Jewish life, for the sounds and the smells and the tastes, of the ways in which we express our values and our memories and our morals. You know, as Jewish people, we're very comfortable with the range of Jewish identities that we claim. Oh, I'm a cultural Jew. I'm a Zionist Jew. I'm a gastronomic Jew. I'm a national Jew. I'm a textual Jew. I'm a secular Jew. We're very comfortable identifying ourselves that way. But when somebody wants to come into the Jewish community, there is only one set of doors through which they can come in formally, and that is the doors of religion. Conversion only exists in one way in the Jewish world. And it is the way of religion. What might it look like to create more entrances into Jewish life? What kind of preparation would we want to ask people to undergo to enter in by taking on a deep, rich cultural identity? What kind of accountability would we demand of them? What would the landscape of our Jewish organizational life look like to provide opportunities for identity building and community building outside of the walls of the synagogue? That's the other narrative that's being challenged today, that we can only secure Jewish identity through affiliation with an institution like a synagogue or a day school. Right? Now, synagogues and day schools breed beautiful social connections and rootedness, but we do, I believe, need more choices to account for the realities of people's lives. Rabbi Resnick mentioned very graciously the model that I developed in northern New Jersey, Sha'ar Communities, which creates communities that revolve around different ways of engaging Jewishly, whether through study, through travel, through Tikkun Olam programs, and even through a very spiritual model of prayer. But keep in mind that all of those circles are not necessarily discrete. There are many, many atheists amongst us who continue to find ritual very, very powerful. And there are also many believers amongst us who no longer find formal worship to be the most meaningful way of expressing their belief in God or a higher power or spirituality. We need choices. We need diversity. We need creativity and innovation. By the way, you know, a lot of people assume that when we're talking about intermarriage, it's much easier to work with people who are coming into the Jewish community by marrying our children or grandchildren who have no independent religious life of their own. We think if they're secular, if they're somehow pariv, they'll be easier to work with, easier to bring to our Shabbos tables, and easier to bring to our Pesach Seders. But you know what? There is social study, there is social science that suggests that people who come into Jewish families with their own robust religious life actually have more appreciation, more empathy, and are more prepared to support the enterprise of building a Jewish home, oftentimes than people who come without that sense of that sensitivity to religion and to spirituality. My point is this, friends, that the boundaries are not always clear as we understand them today in life, nor is their usefulness. We are living through a unique, unprecedented time where precedents are fracturing. And when we are seeking wholeness, when we are seeking new maps, and we're wondering how we're going to recognize our maps to the future as having the impressions of the past, which we care about so much and which we continue to cherish. I learned through the wrestling that I went through on this issue that at the end of the day, my success as a rabbi is not going to be measured by how many people I turn into versions of myself. I'm very comfortable with my Jewish life and with my Jewish commitment, a Jewish identity that I continue to grow every day. But my measure in success as a rabbi is going to be evaluated by how many people I can bring into the deepest sense of connection with who they are, with their values, with their beliefs, so that they can live an authentic and meaningful and engaged Jewish life. There is much at stake here for all of us, for all of our families and our communities, for Judaism and beyond. Our ability to cultivate empathy for multi-faith and multi-heritage couples and families, and to give that empathy form in the shape of community norms and patterns, will not only strengthen their homes, but will make available the resources to empower Jewish couples and homes of all kinds to take responsibility for their Jewish lives and for our collective Jewish future. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope that you'll continue to discuss this together, perhaps with me at lunch. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you again.